Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Well, all of a sudden, politicians seem to be falling all over themselves to reform the $85 billion a year student loan industry. Just yesterday, this all happened yesterday, the House Education Committee voted to send a bill to the floor that would cut subsidies to lenders and use part of the savings to increase Pell Grants, so grants instead of loans. The New York Times ran an op-ed from Madeleine Cunin, the former governor of Vermont and deputy secretary of education in the Clinton administration, urging a switch to more direct loans and fewer guaranteed bank loans. And New York Senator Charles Schumer announced the introduction of legislation to make the application process easier and more transparent. Again, that's just yesterday's activity on this topic. This all comes on the heels of investigations by New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo into improper ties between college financial aid administrators and the loan industry. And that doesn't even include the growing use of private loans that threaten to bankrupt recent graduates. Oh, except that not even bankruptcy will get you out from under your student loan debt thanks to the recent changes in the bankruptcy laws. So when everyone seems to agree that a college degree is necessary for middle-class life, will these reforms go far enough to ensure access to higher education for all? Joining me now to talk about student loans and take your calls on how we got here and where we might go are Stephen Bird of the New America Foundation Think Tank and Anya Kamenetz, whose book Generation Debt, Why Now is a Terrible Time to Be Young, is just out in paperback. So welcome back to the show, Stephen Bird and Anya Kamenetz. Hello.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I should say that President Bush has also urged some of the same reforms that the House bill includes. What spurred all this, Stephen? Was it a change in control of Congress or Andrew Cuomo's investigations?
Well, I would say it's probably a little bit of both. I think that Democrats were frustrated for a number of years that the Bush administration wasn't doing more to help help students afford college. The feeling that they had let the maximum Pell Grant remain flat for 5 years in a row and appeared to really provide little oversight over the student loan industry. And I believe that, you know, the revelations that have occurred over the last several months about aid administrators not providing impartial advice, getting some types of compensation from lenders, really helps spur things along.
And we want to hear from you. Our phones are open at 212-433-WNYC. Our comments page is open on the website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We want to hear your horror stories. We want to hear your suggestions for change. We want to hear your political pressure or concerns about all of this. 212-433-WNYC or go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show to post a comment. Anya, here's a comment that somebody already sent in that is from one of your compadres in Generation Debt. And it says, I have about $100,000 in student loan debt for my undergraduate education, $75,000 in private loans.
Wow.
Not a single person in the financial aid department of the small Minnesota school I attended ever counseled me about the enormous burden I was taking on, aside from telling me to read the promissory note. How is it possible or legal to allow young people with zero assets and no cosigner to sign their lives away with no guidance?
Well, this is a really serious problem. The hearing last week in front of the Senate Banking Committee addressed this question of private loans, which, I mean, if you want to talk about under the radar, the student loan industry as a whole is not very regulated. But when you come to these private alternative unsubsidized loans, which are much, much higher in interest rates, talking about from 8% up to 12%, 18% in some cases, you know, they've grown up because tuition is like a runaway train.
18%
for
a student loan.
They call it a student loan.
When interest rates, you know, are 5%.
Right.
Right? The prime is, you know, is down so low. Why is that legal?
It's legal because we don't have very good laws. I mean, you know, I think that the bankruptcy exemption is really the egregious example of the way that these private loans are not only not regulated, but in a way subsidized. In the 2005 BAPSA Act, you know, they brought private education loans under the same rubric of subsidized education loans. You cannot get rid of these loans in bankruptcy, even though, you know, they're not collateralized debt. And so when people sign up for these loans, and like this poor person, they may not have many other options. They may have exhausted their Stafford loans, or they may not have exhausted their loans.
And so this poor person has a follow-up question, which is, do you have any advice on conquering this debt? She writes, denial just made the situation worse. I tried filing for bankruptcy. That didn't work. Now I've been paying as much as I possibly can per month.
Right.
Yet with the interest up to 9.5%, I don't seem to be making a debt. I feel like my life is over before it has begun. How sad.
That's a really, really sad story, and it's one I think that we're starting to hear more and more about. I mean, there was a time when only, you know, less than a decade ago when it was fairly uncommon for undergraduate students to take on private loans. But because the federal loan limits have remained the same, and because college prices have escalated, and because the government hasn't provided a lot in financial aid, students have had to take on more and more of the debt. I don't think that private loans, you know, I think for some students, particularly graduate and professional students, private loans may serve a, you know, may serve a purpose. The problem, I think, is that it's increasingly lower and middle income students going to college who are taking them out, and students are leaving college then with $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, even $100,000 in debt. How are they supposed to then think about graduate school or getting married or buying houses?
So, Stephen, maybe you could take a step back and explain the different pieces of this puzzle a little bit. There are outright grants, like the Pell Program, not loans, then direct loans from the government, then federally guaranteed loans through lenders like Sallie Mae and others, and then the private loans.
It gets very, very complicated, and unfortunately for students that becomes a problem. The government, you know, created the student aid programs, federal student aid programs, back in the late 60s as part of the war on poverty, and from the first 10 or 15 years, grants were really the primary form of aid that the government provided. But unfortunately, that shifted in the 80s, and college tuitions, of course, skyrocketed. And so the government gives out federal loans, and there are two different types. There's direct loans, in which the government gives the loans directly to students through their colleges. And there's the guaranteed program, which is the same loans. They're just given out by private lenders backed by the government.
Do they have different interest rates?
No, they have the same interest rates. Now, the difference is this extraordinary growth in the private loan program, which is not guaranteed by the government. And that the interesting part about that is that they're many of the same lenders who give out federal student loans also give out private loans. So students often get confused when they hear they're told they're getting a Sallie Mae loan. They think it's a government loan, but Sallie Mae gives out both government loans and private loans.
This was a big concern that was raised in the hearings last week as well, because the lenders came up to say, of course we tell students to go, one, for the free money, two, for the subsidized money, and then to go to our private loans. But the fact is that they make a lot more money on the private loans, and there's some evidence that the way private loans are marketed to students, not only do they not realize the difference, but the difference might actually be obscured, especially if you look at some of these education lenders who only make private loans. They market directly on the internet. Some of their pitches say things like $50,000, it goes direct to you, not to your school, and it makes it sound like such a great deal, and like you shouldn't bother filling out the federal application for student aid. You should just go get a private loan. And so this misleading marketing is a big part of it, and there's actually evidence that a large percentage of students do not max out the federally subsidized loans that they're eligible for before they go to the private loans.
So do you want a law to address that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think that even private loans, we are subsidizing them. We're subsidizing them by, you know, allowing this bankruptcy thing to go on. So I think that should be removed. But at the same time, I think that there's, since we're providing this huge market to schools, and you know, the private loan default rate is not that high yet. So the question is, you know, what are we getting in exchange for that kind of implicit subsidy? And I think yes, you have to regulate, make sure that they're marketed in a way that it's absolutely clear to students, you know, the kind of deals that they're getting.
Anya Kamenetz, author of Generation Debt, Stephen Bird from the New America Foundation, as we talk about our broken student loan system, and Eric in North Bergen. You're on WNYC. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I'm going to say right from the beginning that I was a bit of a bad boy, but so is Merrill Lynch for letting me do this. I was on scholarship for music and had a teaching assistantship and master's degrees that prevented me from having to pay a dime into my education. However, I was still eligible for all of the available student Stafford loans, so I took them all out and invested them.
Invested them, and not in 1990s tech stocks, I hope.
So if anyone could possibly remember as far back as the millennium, the stock market crashed, and so did
I. You did invest them in 1990s tech stocks. Oh.
So we
have a terrible connection. So what's your question real quick? What can you do?
My question is, all of my student loans are defaulted because I did not, well, I went on with music, but have not made the millions that I thought it would do. For me. So with all of my loans defaulted, the entire package, where can I go from here earning, say, $15 an hour?
Stephen Bird, any advice for him?
Well, I was wondering have you tried to consolidate your debt? You can consolidate into the direct student loan program and get an income contingent repayment plan in which you would pay as part of your a percentage of your income. For a lot of people who have federal loan debt, that's a good way to sort of rehabilitate your loans.
All right, Eric, I'm going to leave it there. Good luck to you. We mentioned Madeleine Cunin before, the former governor of Vermont and Clinton administration official who had an op-ed in the Times yesterday. She is urging that we move to direct loans, one of those categories of loans that come right from the government, and so they have good interest rates. As a more common option. But some conservatives see that as adding to the federal bureaucracy and leaving the market forces out of the picture. Do you think that would create different problems, Anya?
Well, the term privatization or competition in the student loan industry is so kind of twisted and fraught because it's the lenders, the private lenders that are operating under huge government subsidies, they don't really have to compete. They get access to the students by marketing directly to colleges. And, the idea that there's open competition for prices to students is really kind of not really happening.
But this is what some of the conservative critics say. They say that one reason that tuition has climbed so much is the availability of all these loans. So there was no price pressure on schools. And if you make loans more available, if you make money cheaper, then tuition is just going to go up because that's what the market will do.
The tuition part of the picture should not be ignored. We need to work with colleges to make sure the costs are controlled. And colleges have been very resistant to the idea that they should be open to any kind of accountability or transparency as to how they make their tuition pricing decisions. But I'll tell you, Brian, I've been to state after state where colleges are raising their prices. They're not really talking to students or community members about why they make those decisions. I think that there needs to be some accountability there. I do think it's the federal government's responsibility, and it's going to be a painful situation because colleges, they don't want to do that, you know.
Stephen Bird, anything on that and the effect on tuition?
Well, I think that there is some good evidence that the availability of loans has made it easier for colleges to, you know, raise their prices without worrying about losing students, that students will have a way to afford to pay, even if it's through taking out huge loan debts.
Demand-side economics.
Yeah, I don't know that. I don't think it translates into college officials, you know, sitting around a table and saying, oh, look, they're, you know, we could raise our price this much and they'll take out that much in loans. But I think it does kind of serve, you know, in a larger way. At New America, we do think that there needs to be systematic reform of the loan programs. And what we wouldn't go to 100% direct lending. We know a lot of universities don't want to do that. So we believe basically that it should be up to the that the government should have private lenders have to compete to set their subsidies, so that the government isn't setting the subsidies themselves, but that there is some sort of a method, maybe a kind of auction, in which lenders compete to make or to collect on loans.
When we continue in a minute, we'll talk more about the private loans, what Andrew Cuomo calls the Wild West of the college loan business. We'll take more of your comments from our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Check out our online video picks. Every week we choose five videos from the web, which I anchor in a picks video. This week, they include a clip that Bill Moyers put on the web of President Lyndon Johnson musing at the very beginning of the Vietnam War that it would be a bad thing to escalate that war and really get involved in Vietnam. It's so interesting considering what actually happened after that. So check that out as one of our five online video picks at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We continue with how to fix the student loan industry with Anya Kamenetz, whose book Generation Debt, Why Now is a Terrible Time to Be Young, is just out in paperback, and Stephen Hurd with the think tank, the New America Foundation, Stephen Bird from the New America Foundation, I'm sorry. And here is a comment that someone posted on our comments page of the website, and it says, when I got my undergraduate degree, I left with $74,000 of debt. Now my fiance and I are trying to buy an apartment, but even with my great credit score, I can barely get a $100,000 mortgage. Is there anything that I can do as a first-time home buyer? Anything about that situation in particular, Stephen?
I think I'm going to kick that one over to Anya.
Anya?
I mean, they're going to look at your overall debt levels. I mean, if there's a way that your husband can qualify for, if he doesn't have the same debt level as you, if there's any way that it could be on his income to qualify for the mortgage, that's the only thing that I would really say that you can do, because you can't hide the debt.
You know? And here's another one. This says, attended Montclair State-funded school in New Jersey, late 90s through early 2000s. When I had applied to my university for financial aid, I was only granted a small Pell Grant and then offered a loan from Sallie Mae through my university directly. I didn't know any better then. I didn't know who Sallie Mae was. I didn't know there was a monopoly and that this should probably be illegal. I hope my university's financial aid officers really enjoyed all those cruises they undoubtedly attended. I am currently carrying $18,000 and work in nonprofits. And this brings me, Anya, to something that we were talking about off the air. You're proposing student loan amnesty for some people who got caught up in some of this.
I've been in touch with people, and, you know, the default rate is very low. After 2 years, it's only about 5%. So it's a small number of people that we're talking about. But the people that do get saddled with these multiple six figures of loans, once you go into default, they can really explode and triple, quadruple with penalties and interest. And you have people that are trapped in garnished wages. They're seizing tax refunds, and they really can't live any kind of a life like this. And so actually in Illinois, the State Guarantee Agency is considering allowing people who have defaulted loans to repay just the interest, the principal and some interest, but waive all of these extra fees if people actually go into bankruptcy and they have a defaulted loan. And the idea is, let them get on with their lives. Let them participate in the economy. You know, it's a small minority of people, but it's really the people who suffer the most. And it's one of the things that makes our system so unfair.
I think we know, Stephen, from a certain other topic in the news, that a lot of politicians don't like the word amnesty.
Well, that's true.
Could they look more favorably on it for defaulting former college students than for illegal immigrants?
Well, I think it would be an uphill battle, but I think that there are some really good arguments that Anya's made along this, and I'd imagine she would get some support, but it definitely would be an uphill fight.
Ken in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Anya. My question is for Anya. I'm currently a grad student in University in New York, and essentially the way it works is that I'm channeled to take out my loans from a private lender. It's the $18,500 in federal loans, but instead of taking them directly from the government, I'm basically channeled towards Citibank. And I was wondering if Anya could explain in basically clear language exactly what the ramifications for this are, that I'm owing this money to Citibank as opposed to federal tap and tell, which is what I got my master's in. And I owe money directly to the government for my master's, but now I'm doing my doctorate in another school.
Right. Well, Ken, this is a really good point. The choice between direct lending and a bank loan is something your school makes, not something that you have the choice to make yourself. Within that, you don't have to go with your school's preferred lender. Citibank might be the preferred lender, but you actually have a choice to take out from any certified education lender. Some people look to lenders like My Rich Uncle, which advertises a higher discount. Whether you have your Stafford loans from a direct lending program or the bank loan program shouldn't make much difference under most circumstances. You're going to get the same terms, the same kinds of discounts. If you find that that's not true after you graduate, as Stephen mentioned earlier, you do have the choice to consolidate your loans with the direct loan program, get back into the direct loan program by getting one consolidation loan, and then you'll be under the rubric of the direct loan program. You'll have protections like income contingent repayment and possibly forgiveness after 25 years. So in the future, you can get back into the direct loan program.
My counter to that, thanks, by the way, is that I don't actually have a choice in that I did try my first semester. I took it out actually from a not-for-profit credit organization in Ithaca, but that basically became impossible. I mean, you're really, really channeled towards taking this. And if you know your rent's due on your New York apartment and your landlord's breaking down your door, you really don't have a choice.
You're paying the rent first,
right?
Ken, thank you. Well, this whole idea of schools having a preferred lender,
right?
Is that ever not corrupt?
I think we've seen, you know, colleges have folded very quickly. A lot of financial aid officers have lost their jobs over this. They've signed the code of conduct.
We in the paper today, Antioch College is going out of business.
Right, because of this scandal. Well, kind of strange comeuppance there. But I think that it's sort of an inherently problematic process. I mean, on the one hand, you have to look at financial aid offices. It is convenient in some sense for them to have business with certain lenders and not have it. I mean, it's already complicated enough. But at the same time, I think we're seeing that, you know, students have a problem with it. Parents have a problem with it.
Stephen Bird from the New America Foundation. Same question.
I mean, I think that, you know, we have definitely found that there are problems with they've definitely found a lot of problems with the preferred lender lists. And, you know, we still do believe, though, that most aid administrators, or that, you know, we're still hope that most aid administrators have their students' best interests in mind.
But let me ask you this. Who gets what from a preferred lender arrangement?
Who gets what from the preferred lender arrangement?
Yes.
I mean, I guess that for aid administrators, in some sense, like the simplicity of only having to deal with a smaller number of lenders. I mean, some national universities have, you know, students, you know, when you have students coming from all over the country, you could have thousands of different lenders.
Do the students get a better rate?
And no.
The hope would be that students would get a better rate. What we're finding in a lot of cases is that that is not always the first, and sometimes it's not the second or the third priority. I guess the area where I think this is really potentially a problem is private loans again, where in the federal program, the differences are not that big. Congress has set the interest rates, at least has set the maximum interest rate at
18%.
Oh, no, on federal loans.
On federal loans. But these, you know, what Andrew Cuomo calls the Wild West of the college loan business, these private loans.
The private loans is where the real problem is.
Charging up to 18%. But these lenders defend themselves by saying, look, the interest they're charging is still less than students would pay credit card companies.
Oy vey. We're going to put college on credit? Is that the solution? I mean,
I think one of the biggest problems here is that we're seeing more and more low-income students and middle-income students having to take out these private loans, and you know, they shouldn't have to be. They shouldn't have to take out these loans in the first place.
I want to tell our listeners, we've got about a dozen comments, including mostly people's stories, on our comments page on the website. If you all want to continue to talk to each other about this segment, about this topic after the show, maybe compare notes, trade advice, whatever, that page will stay active after the show. So just go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and you'll see the student aid page. And here's one of those comments. And this, to me, is, you know, used to be the $64,000 question. I guess now it's the $64 million question. Long ago, we decided that high school education was so important that we would provide it free, supported by our own taxes. Isn't it time to do the same for college education? Is that just too radical a thought for 21st century America, Anya?
I think that there's a number of different questions. I asked the question in my book, you know, we have about 27% of adults now that have a bachelor's degree. What are we looking for? Do we need a 50% bachelor's degree world? You know, the number of jobs is not out there. So the real issue is, do people have access to education that helps them find meaningful jobs and helps them expand their horizons? Do I think that means a free four-year college degree for every American citizen? I don't think that's where everybody is at. I think we need to raise up vocational education. We need to raise up associate's degrees, strengthen our community college system where half of all students go. And that's the path for reform. There's definitely room for more funding.
But Stephen Bird, short of free college education for everyone, we had a system in this country after World War II which was considered very mainstream, known as the GI Bill. And that was basically college loans and grants for all, at least all men who were coming back from World War II. But at that time, you know, overwhelmingly the men were the single breadwinners for families. So maybe some dual gender version of the GI Bill linked to whatever excuse of social service they want to link it to, you know, like they linked it to service in World War II at the time. Would that just be unrealistically prohibitive, or is it just that our politics have changed?
I mean, I think to some extent the politics have changed, unfortunately. But I think what we're starting to see now, and I think that what the Democrats are trying to do, is to really revive the Pell Grant program for low-income students. It's been, as I said before, for 5 years, the maximum Pell Grant didn't go up. It was left at $4,050. And we just, yesterday, the House Education and Labor Committee passed a bill that would bring it over 5,000. I have to get back to around 5,200 or something. And so I think that there are efforts to sort of revive the system to try to get the buying power of Pell Grants up. I think, you know, we obviously would like to see that go even higher. I think we also would like to see institutions, colleges, be more responsible with their institutional aid money and not give so much of it out in merit aid, but instead keep it focused on low-income students.
My guests for just another few minutes, Stephen Bird of the New America Foundation and Anya Kamenetz, author of Generation Debt, Why Now is a Terrible Time to Be Young, just out in paperback, talking about how to fix our broken student loan system. And here's one more from the comments page. This is another solution recommendation, short of free college for all. And she writes, when I was a high school student in California, there seemed to be an attitude that any student was entitled to attend any college he or she desired without first evaluating the financial impact. Mm-hmm. As a California resident, I was amazed that many of my peers opted for private institutions when California has a first-class public university system. Mm-hmm. As a Berkeley alum, I received a splendid education for the affordable price of $3,500 a semester. Perhaps we should start encouraging students to attend public universities rather than private ones.
I think we've hit on a really important point. The higher education system is really two-tiered. The private colleges exist in a sort of a universe of their own where they can charge anything they want, and middle-class students are clamoring to get in their doors because the status of the name college is so ruling people's ideas. And so much of our discourse about higher ed goes on about Harvard and Yale, when the fact is that 80% of students already attend public institutions. That's where our bread and butter is. That's where the heart and soul of the country is. That's what we need to be strengthening. And part of that might be for students and families to think about college differently, not think about it just as a status competition, but about the quality of the education that they're going to be receiving. And the cost has got to be a factor in there as well.
Ginger, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ginger.
Hi.
So?
Well, I got a private loan. In addition to my federal loans for graduate school at Brown, I got a private loan from an organization in Kentucky called Access Group. Now, the problem with this loan is that it basically amounts to being a credit card, and they don't tell you this. You can't consolidate it. And once you graduate and you have to start paying back, there's no way that you can control the interest rate. They can change it at any point. Mm-hmm. They can raise it. They can change your payments. And this is something that, you know, this was on a list of loans that was recommended to me from my financial aid institution, which I needed to get more money because my federal loans didn't cover everything. And, you know, lo and behold, I find out after the fact that, you know, it's basically whatever they want it to be. It's whatever kind of loan they want to make it.
Is that really unusual, Stephen?
I think that right there is the problem, is that most students don't understand at the point that they're taking out a private loan, what a private loan really is. And as we said, a private loan is more like a credit card. The interest rates are variable. They're not capped. In the federal loan program, the interest rates are kept low, and they are fixed or capped. And so I think this is sort of the tragedy, I think, and this is really what Congress needs to look into for on the private loan side, is ways to make sure that students understand what they're getting before they actually take the loans.
And the simplest solution might just be, as they did do in the House committee yesterday, raise federal student loan limits so people don't have to take out as many private loans. They can take out more federal loans. You know, it's a short-term fix, but I think it would really help.
So is Congress on the way to fixing this, in your opinion, Anya?
I think that the progress has been remarkable. The areas that are not yet addressing have to do with repayment. They expanded forgiveness, but there need to be more income contingent type repayment plans that are tied to your income so people aren't staggering under these unbelievably high repayment burdens. So repayment plans deal with bankruptcy exemption, and, you know, going on to the future, I think, you know, write your congressman and make sure that you your voices are heard as students.
I do have to say one other thing. It is one of the good things, I think, that has come out of sort of these loan scandal stories is people are actually talking about private loans, because up until this year on Capitol Hill, you never heard about private loans. And so this has really been happening under the radar, but it's affecting more and more students. And Senator Dodd has a bill out that would definitely make a lot of this much more transparent to students, and I think that that's a really good start. So I am happy that private loans are finally starting to get the attention that they deserve, and that students desperately need them.
All right. The segment is over, but folks, you can continue to talk to each other about this on the Student Aid page of our website. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show, and you'll see the Student Aid page, and comments remain on. Stephen Bird, Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation. Anya Kamenetz, author of Generation Debt, Why Now is a Terrible Time to Be Young, now out in paperback. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thing to do, student loan, but right now I wish that I had thought it through. Student loan, you know, the day I graduated, I got a special letter. Student loan.